from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse. Thank you very much for tuning in today. We are talking about utilities, power utilities across the state, and particular rate increases that they have requested, including Xcel Energy in the La Crosse listening area. And we'll talk about what those increases have been requested, what level they've been requested at, and why, and a little bit of background information courtesy of the Citizens Utility Board here in Wisconsin. Joining me is the executive director of that organization, Tom Content. First of all, Tom, welcome to Newsmakers.
Oh, thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you.
First of all, tell me a little bit about the Citizens Utility Board. Is it best described as like a consumer watchdog group, or how do you categorize yourself that way?
That's a good way to describe it. We're a nonprofit and nonpartisan independent consumer advocate. So we're a nonprofit organization, and we're a consumer advocate for all the utility customers who are residential, farm, and small business customers in Wisconsin.
Okay.
So we're there as the voice of the people to make sure there's balance and that the customer's voice is heard anytime there are decisions made about our monopoly utilities.
And you do not just press releases, but blog posts and social media videos and all kinds of information about the different activities regarding utilities in Wisconsin. And that's how this came to my attention, your recent blog post on the proposed utility rate increases, and in particular, an article that the La Crosse Tribune wrote about that. So credit to our friends at the Tribune for highlighting the topic and bringing up an opportunity to talk to you. As sort of a bird's eye view, talk about like what you're seeing in terms of the rate hikes that are being requested across the state.
Sure. Well, what we're seeing right now, and utilities just filed proposals in the last few weeks, and across the state, we're looking at about $500 million of new increases that are being proposed. And that's comes on the heels or just after prices went up January 1 for many utility customers on the electric side. So that's, we're in a challenge. And part of what happened is we had such incredible run up in both the price of natural gas as well as the price of coal for the utilities. For our utility coal plants over the last year. As a result, for last year, we saw increases across the state on bills in January that range from about 5 to 11%, depending on the utility. And now we're talking, now the utilities have more proposed increases in front of the Public Service Commission to the tune of $500 million.
So $500 million, and that is across a bunch of companies statewide. Here in
Correct.
Southwestern Wisconsin, people will mostly be, now we're not talking, for the purposes of this conversation, we're not necessarily talking about like the cooperative organizations like in Vernon County or in elsewhere. We're talking
Correct.
About as your publication put it, the investor owned utilities, which would include Xcel Energy in our area. What is Xcel's increase request look like?
So Xcel is seeking to increase electricity rates by nearly 5%. That's 4.8%. It's about a $40 million increase. And then which as well, they're also seeking a natural gas increase, which on the local portion of your natural gas bill, which would be $9 million, or about just over 5%.
How does that compare? You said everybody pretty much just made increases already in January, just several months ago. How does this compare to last year's increase?
So this actually is a little bit lighter than last year, at least as to Xcel, and Xcel's increase isn't as high as some of the other proposals right now. We have two other utilities, Madison Gas and Electric, and Alliant, which is also known as Wisconsin Power and Light in southern Wisconsin, are seeking two-step increases over the next 2 years, and they're looking at more on the range of 7%, for MGenie and up to for over 14% for Alliant. It's going to be a busy year at the Public Service Commission because there are so many cases and so many proposals to raise rates at the same time.
So when a company makes a request like this, is that likely to be what the final number looks like, or are there? Do you already know they're asking for a highball number, and the final is almost definitely going to come in lower than that, or how does that usually work?
Well, it is kind of like an opening bid, and generally by the time the Public Service Commission finishes reviewing these requests, the final number is lower than what's being sought. And so the job of the utility regulator, the Public Service Commission, as well as CUB as the consumer advocate, because we have in-house economists and experts that are going to be diving into this. So our job is to find the areas of savings that can bring it down from what's being proposed, so that by the end of the year, we're hoping that customers, as a state, we're not looking at a $500 million increase.
So these proposals that have come in over the last few weeks are basically, it's a request for the increase that would take effect at the beginning of next calendar year.
That's correct. Yes, and so then the cases take most of the year to proceed, and essentially a lot of the work happens behind the scenes, where the Public Service Commission actually has a staff of auditors that go through all these proposals and ask detailed questions about, you know, basically telling utilities, well, justify why this number is so much higher than the last time. It's and in a variety of categories. And we do the same thing. We don't have auditors per se, but with our economists, we're looking at areas where we can see savings. And one area where we already see the potential for savings is in paring back the profits that the utilities are making and have been making, because they've been making far too much for far too long.
Okay. Now, up to now, you've been talking about basically factual details about how a company might request a rate or what rate is being requested. Now you're saying that they've been making far too much, which is somewhat of an editorial statement. So why don't you explain exactly what you mean by far too much?
Sure. So basically, and we are the advocate. So we're basically there as the advocate for the small customers.
Sure. Yep.
And for fairness, and one aspect of fairness is to making sure that there's balance. But obviously, these utilities have shareholders; they have a fiduciary responsibility to try to grow their earnings for their shareholders. But every time they grow their earnings, that causes cost pressure on Wisconsin customers, and across the state, our electric rates are second highest in the Midwest here in Wisconsin. So that's one of the reasons we focus on the profits. And when I said they're been too high, it's because our profits have exceeded the national average for utilities around the country. And then our lead economist has points in his work to evidence and studies around the country that show that the utilities are seeking too much, and that even the profits that they're already getting are much more than they need to raise capital on Wall Street. In other words, they're already getting too much. They're seeking more, and the study from the Berkeley Business School found that the customers across the country are overpaying by billions of dollars every year, just on the issue of these high profits. And so that's an issue we want to focus on, especially in the Xcel case. Because in Xcel's case, they actually are trying to increase their profit rate from 10% to 10.25% in this case. And so the profit, there are a lot of judgment calls that a Public Service Commission has to make when deciding a rate case. And they have discretion on deciding what that profit rate should be.
So these companies are not necessary. It's not necessarily like they're in some sort of financial distress and they suddenly need to raise rates by this much in order to be profitable at all. It's more a matter of they're going to raise rates. They're going to make a profit. It's just a matter of how much profit they're going to be allowed to make.
That's correct. I mean, the way the system works is that the PSC, you don't want the utilities to have so to you don't want the utilities to fail and go out of business because it's a monopoly utility. So that, what would happen if a utility were to fail? That would not be good. But on the other hand, you don't want things to be so out of whack on the other side that they're basically too enriched on the backs of the customers. And just looking at the profits that the utilities made last year across the state, the four main utility companies in Wisconsin, just their profits alone were over $1.3 billion just for 1 year last year.
Now, we talked about this, our conversation today. These rate increases are basically on behalf of the investor-owned utilities. In other words, the corporate utilities, and not so much the co-op utilities. Do co-ops have a similar process that they go through? Are they regulated in a similar way?
They have a very different process. We do get questions from co-op members from time to time concerning their bills, or concerning in particular the high fixed charges that that appear on their bills, so-called meter charge or customer charge. But under state law in Wisconsin, the Public Service Commission regulates only those investor-owned utilities. So those are the utilities whose parents are traded on Wall Street with, on the stock market. And then also the municipally owned utilities. So communities that own their own power company, whether that's the likes of which include Shawnee or Manitowoc in different parts of the state. But the main, so the for the co-ops, they have to answer to their members. Each co-op has to answer to its own members as far when it in terms of the who gets to be on the board of the co-op, and as far as how it's really a member communication between the co-ops and the members is a process of how the rates are set for those.
This may be coming out of left field. Do you know enough about typical rates among co-ops throughout Wisconsin to know whether those rates between these publicly traded entities and local co-ops are somewhat comparable?
I don't know specifically on co-ops, but just because one of my sources that I've used over the years when I was a journalist covering the utilities and still rely on it is there's a comparison tool of for electric rates for various utilities in Wisconsin, but that only compares the municipal utilities and the investor-owned utilities. My educated hunch is that the bills for the co-ops are going to be lower than the investor-owned just because there isn't that extra layer of profit. In other words, a co-op isn't looking to make a profit just as a municipal utility isn't looking to make a profit. And what we've seen around the state is that if you compare, say, some of the Wisconsin Xcel and some of the other Wisconsin publicly traded utilities with the municipals, a municipal utility customer generally pays 30% or more less per month than the investor-owned.
So a person might be listening to a conversation like this, and the fact that their power bill is going up doesn't come as a shock to them. The natural inclination is, I don't like that. It's going to be more expensive. But how can somebody look at this rate increase or any other increase in their utility costs and determine for themselves whether they should think it's reasonable or not? If they're listening to this conversation and saying those guys are talking Greek, like how do they make sense of it and judge for themselves whether an increase is reasonable or unreasonable?
I mean, you raise a really good point. This is really complex. This can be complex and a bit wonky at times, but what we're trying to do at CUB is educate people that there are a lot of issues going on that people do need to care about, and we want people to be more involved in the process. And so we're encouraging people to participate, whether that's weighing in the public hearings later on this year or in public comments on the PSC website. On the PSC website, once that process gets going, that's not really at that stage yet. But I think what we're that's one of the reasons that CUB exists, though, is to bring a voice to the customers that don't have one today, or don't have the time or to participate. So we are able to, with a team, team of economists and an attorney, we have a small staff of six, but we're able to have the in-house expertise to really understand these issues and help communicate what we think is going to be fair for folks. And what will happen later on this year is prior to the public hearings, everybody essentially will put their cards on the table. So the results of the PSC staff audit will be out. So you will find out exactly what kind of cuts are being proposed by the PSC. We'll have our arguments on the table regarding profits and other issues. We'll be weighing in on how the impact of these increases for low-income customers can be dealt with. And so that it's going to be it's a process, and it's it does it does it may feel like Greek, but it's something that where we think that the more there's participation in what we call energy democracy, the better results we're going to get from the state overseers of the utilities.
I'm looking at sort of kind of like the top line snapshot that was in your blog post, and I'm going to give an opportunity in a moment for you to let people know where they can find your information for themselves. But it's basically the graphic that shows the overall rate increases for the previous fiscal year and or calendar year and that upcoming.
Right.
And it shows Xcel, as you mentioned, with the total proposed rate increase, the overall rate increase request of 7.8%. But then it shows multiple utilities that request a couple years at a time. What's the difference there? Why are some people making requests for 24 and 25 while others are just making requests for 24?
That's a really good question. So, for Madison Gas and Electric and Alliant, I think part of it is they wanted to spread the costs, spread out the impact of the increases, but also it's because a lot of the reasons for some of the increases we're seeing right now are the additions to the of new solar plants in the or in the, in some cases some new natural gas plants, and the. They go into rates at a specific time, so you have to actually build the project for it to actually come in, and it has to be helping keep the lights on, if you will, before you can charge your customers for it if you're a utility. And so, and that's why those other ones are phased in, whereas Xcel is maybe not at the point in its building program where it has a second phase coming in 2025.
So just taking one of those, and our listeners might not be as familiar with these names, but in the case of Alliant requesting like 8.5% for 2024, and then an additional 5.5% for 2025, speaking in rounded up terms. Is there a chance that they could come back and say regarding that 5.5% for 2025, just kidding, we really need that to be 8.5 too?
No, because the PSC is trying to send a message to stay that utilities can only come in every other year for what's called a full rate case. And so if Alliant, whatever decision Alliant is made for Alliant this year, will hold for next year as well. The only exception to that is they can still update one item, which is their fuel costs for the next year, for the following year. But overall, one of the things we're seeing, and there's a challenge right now for both the PSC and for active organizations in this area like CUB, is that we have all five utilities in front of the PSC right now. And right now, the Public Service Commission is wants the utilities to go back to what had been the norm for about 30 years, which is that utilities only come in if they need increases there. They should be coming in every other year instead of every year. And so, starting next year, The PSC has sent a letter to all five of these utilities saying that starting next year, we want to be they want to be back on an every other year cycle. So in the case of Xcel in the La Crosse area, they would be in for a rate increase this year. They already are, but they would not be expected to come in next year, and that would they would the PSC is sending a signal that please don't come in next year because we're going to be busy with other cases.
Okay, and one more comparative question about some differences in how these companies are making their requests. You see Xcel with a request of 7.8% for the year, and then you see WPS with what looks like a decrease next year of 2.1%. With all of these companies coming and asking for all of this money, how is it the WPS doesn't need an increase?
Well, it is kind of interesting because we don't see that too often, actually. So, and what's going on there is WPS is seeing about a $10 million increase attached to some of their new projects, like new solar and battery storage projects that are being built. But on the other hand, they're starting to see the results of having more of having more renewable energy and other and for other reasons, their fuel costs are actually coming down. So an advantage of solar, which is why we're seeing so many proposals being so many projects being built and seeing so more being proposed, is that when the sun shines, there's no fuel cost. When the wind blows, just as when the wind blows, there's no fuel cost. So the commodity costs attached to coal and natural gas are going to go down for all these utilities as they ramp up on the renewable side. And so, and that's one of the advantages that the utilities have been touting, including Xcel and all the utilities. And in this case, it just shows that that's actually happening. But it's happening for WPS at this moment and not quite happening for the others yet.
And if people are interested in boning up on the subject matter ahead of the availability of those public comment opportunities, where can they find more information about Cub and about your analysis?
Sure, no. So our website is a good resource, as is our YouTube channel. So CubWI.org is our website, and we have blog posts there and more information about both Cub and what we do. We have a link there to sign up for our newsletter to get updates by email. And then we also have a podcast, and we discussed the rate increases on one of our recent episodes called Cub Tracks. And so that's available on podcast channels, and it's also available on YouTube with the at CubWI, youtube.com/@CubWI. So a bunch of resources there. We're look and certainly if there are community groups that want, or Rotary clubs or chambers of commerce or neighborhood associations that want to find out more, we're available. We're hoping to be we're hoping to educate more customers because one of our missions, we have two main missions. One is advocacy for the small customers, the residential and small business customers. And the other mission is to educate. And so we have resources on our website on saving on your energy bills, but we're also available to come do public presentations on saving on your bills and where we like to come out around the state to talk about that and get input from the customers about what they're seeing on their bill.
That's Tom Content. He is the executive director of Cub Wisconsin, which is the Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin. Tom, thank you very much for spending some time with us on Newsmakers today.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
And of course, we reached out to Xcel Energy, who has many customers in our listening area, and they haven't been in touch with us as of this recording. But we'll be happy to bring you their comments if they're able to get in touch with us in the near future. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to hear a previous episode of the show or part of this conversation you might have missed, you can find them all on our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. That's wpr.org/newsmakers. We're back in just a moment here on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, it's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. Early in the last school year, UWL alumnus Truman T. Lowe was honored when the Fine Arts Building on campus was renamed in his honor. It's now called the Truman T. Lowe Center for the Arts at UW-La Crosse. And ahead of that renaming, we talked to someone who knew and worked with Truman Lowe a lot and wrote a book about him, in fact. Dr. Joe Ortel is the Nystrom Professor Emeritus of Art History at Beloit College. She's author of the book Woodland Reflections, The Art of Truman Lowe. And we talked to Joe about her friendship and her professional association with Truman Lowe. And here is part of that conversation.
He was a sculptor and an installation artist in a sort of avant-garde modernist kind of vein. And he worked primarily with wood, both natural sticks and branches, and then also lumber. So he was making sculpture and installations that were about both his Native American, his Ho-Chunk heritage, and also the natural environment of the upper Midwest. He really considered himself a woodland Indian. He grew up in the Ho-Chunk community outside of Black River Falls, and he was surrounded during his childhood and youth by the traditional arts and crafts that the Ho-Chunk made for the tourist trade at that time. So he was surrounded by crafts and arts and using one's hands, and he was also fascinated with drawing. So his public school teachers even gave him the opportunity to use his classrooms when he was on study halls. So that gives you a sense that he was always kind of drawing, but it wasn't until, I mean, he didn't go to UW-La Crosse with the idea or the intention of becoming an artist. He really kind of floundered, if I can say that, for several years and tried out different art or different majors before he settled on art education. And once he became an art education major, he experimented with all kinds of mediums, printmaking, sculpture, ceramics. He did all sorts of things, and he really sort of thrived in that environment. I'm trying to think what else here.
Well, I'm wondering. You said that he was involved, and I've read elsewhere that his parents were involved in making handcrafts, you know, for sale for tourists and things like that, and. He was a very, very deep and serious artist that we all have come to know. And, you know, touristy stuff. I mean, you make stuff for tourists because it's what they'll buy, not because it's what speaks to you as an artist. How did that process of making those things for the tourist trade influence his art? Like, did he go the direction he did artistically to kind of get away from that? Or was there still an element of that incorporated in his work later?
Well, that's an excellent question, because he really, while he was at UW-La Crosse, he really sort of was experimenting with all sorts of Western Eurocentric kinds of avant-garde art styles. And he sort of left his Ho-Chunk crafts and arts behind for a while. But then gradually, as he found himself, as he matured as an artist, he, after graduate school and after teaching a few years, he realized that he really, as I said, was a woodland Indian, and he started drawing on his images and the history that he was taught as a child and at the Indian mission outside of Black River Falls. So it wasn't so much that he rejected the arts and crafts. In fact, he really was a champion of all arts and crafts of Native Americans. Even though his work was really in a kind of modernist Western fine art vein, he was always very happy to see traditional arts and crafts by Native Americans as well.
You talked about his art being in a more of a Western vein, and that reminded me about in a lot of disciplines, not just art, but in academia, there is this Eurocentricity in a lot of the art that is sort of academically approved or that is considered high art, whether it's in visual art or in theater or in music or in a lot of these things. Did he have to kind of defend his own artistic voice as he tried to bring more of his heritage into it?
I don't think as he brought it into his work, no. That's another really interesting question. It was always, and I've been working on my remarks for Monday's ceremony, and I'm having trouble, you know, talking about what's the difference between arts and crafts and fine arts, what he did, and those traditional Ho-Chunk arts and crafts like basketry and beadwork and that sort of thing. He kind of saw the two as being on a continuum. He wasn't concerned about categories, except that he did understand that we human beings and art historians, especially, I have to say, that we really like categories. We like to put things in boxes, as he said. And so he was always interested in kind of expanding popular conceptions of what contemporary Native American art looked like, what it could encompass, so that he drew upon those Native arts and crafts that he grew up with and other tribes' arts and crafts as well. But then he also was interested in contemporary art, in non-Native influences as well. So he kind of melded or intertwined the two in his artwork.
Now, I'm curious about your knowledge of him and awareness of his work. When did you first become acquainted with Truman Lowe's work?
Oh, gosh, that was about 23 or 24 years ago. I was teaching in the art department at UW-Madison, and I was teaching a modern and contemporary art history class for them. And it was the end of a spring semester, and I was exhausted, and I didn't want to give any more lectures or, you know, prepare any more talks. And so I invited artists from the art department to come and give talks about their own art. And Truman was one of the few who graciously agreed to come and talk to my class about his own artwork. And that was my first introduction, really. And I was just mesmerized both by the artwork, the imagery, the sculptural forms, and then also the way he spoke about his art. He was really thoughtful, and he sort of gave his artwork a number of layers. So there were a number of ways you could enter into it, if you will. And that was the beginning of our friendship. And it was shortly after that that I decided I wanted to write about him. And I thought I could write a book about him in a year or two. And he always used to tease me about that, because it actually took 10 years for me to fully understand both Wisconsin art, Ho-Chunk art, Native American art, and his own influences as well.
Well, when you so were, still, yeah, when was, you were, go ahead. Your book is called Woodland Reflections, The Art of Truman Lowe. You talked about how long it took you to write it. When you start actually putting pen to paper and deciding, you know, how much to describe of him as an American artist and as a Native American artist and as a Wisconsin artist, and how do you see all of those intersectionalities melding together to create him?
Oh, gosh, it's not easy. And that's one of the challenges for me, I think. He really, you know, he moved very fluidly between his Ho-Chunk heritage and his background, and then the university setting and his academic career. And then later he worked as a curator of contemporary Native American art at the Smithsonian's new National Museum of the American Indian. And he always sort of moved fluidly through all of those. So the challenge for me really was, how do I talk about all the influences of his work and let them all sort of speak without kind of narrowing him down or pigeonholing him, really?
You can find any number of videos, short and long clips of Truman Lowe talking about his work online, and I have. And it's interesting because he doesn't strike one as being unconfident in himself, but he really is quite soft spoken and unassuming in the way that he describes himself and his art. What was that like to try to get him to open up in a way that you could actually then turn into a written work about his output?
Well, that's really interesting, because I remember the first time he invited me out to see his studio where he was working out in Middleton. I didn't really prepare that many questions. I just thought, okay, I'll see what bubbles up. And he was very, not reluctant, but he was very short on words. He didn't give me a lot. And I think he was sort of testing me. He wasn't sure that he could trust me, really. So it was, at the beginning, it was kind of a challenge. But then as we got to know each other, I sort of fully understood his ideas, and he did open up much more as we got to know each other.
You talked about him incorporating different kinds of wood, both lumber and like found like sticks and different things in his work. Did he always work in those media primarily?
Well, that too is fascinating, because when he was at La Crosse, he was working in ceramics. He showed a bunch of ceramic eggs that were very brightly painted that looked kind of like pop art, or, you know, they were kind of funny. And then when he was in graduate school at UW-Madison in the early 1970s, he was working with sheets of plastic, literally sheets of plastic. And of course, this was the early 1970s, and plastic was the latest, hottest medium material for artists, modern artists, to be experimenting with. And it was only later, after he did a stint teaching in Kansas at Emporia State College, that he kind of returned to the natural materials of the Ho-Chunk, and particularly of his parents. His father made these exquisite wooden basket handles, and his mother made these splint plat baskets that were just exquisite. So he sort of returned to those roots as he matured as an artist.
How was that that stint in Kansas that you mentioned? He seems to have kind of realized a lot about who he was by moving away from who he was for that period of time.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. He really, he was, I wouldn't say he was distressed about being on the plains in Kansas, but he realized, he said, he often said he discovered he was a woodland Indian, and he liked being surrounded by the bluffs and the rivers and freshwater streams of Wisconsin, of the upper Midwest. So that really was kind of a realization that he came to as he was, while he was down there. They were only down there, I think, for 1 year. He was teaching down there, but he realized that he needed to come home. So
it sort of cemented his identity within himself in a way.
Absolutely, yeah. And to go back to your earlier question, when you were talking about that he was very unassuming, he was. He had a great sense of humor, kind of a goofy sense of humor. But one thing that was particularly enticing to me working with him was he didn't take himself too seriously. In other words, he was always challenging himself. He was very serious about his art, and he'd been very thoughtful about his art, but he also loved to play. So he really he did have a strong sense of himself without being arrogant or egotistical. He was quite the opposite, I have to say.
Most of his career, he was a teacher. He studied art education. He was a professor at UW-Madison from where he retired. Talk about Truman Lowe as a teacher and what role he played in the artistic lives and development of his students.
Well, as you can imagine, he taught, I think it was 35 years at UW-Madison. So he touched a number of students at UW, and he really mentored a number of students. I think what students say about him the most is that they felt that he gave them freedom to find themselves. So in other words, students would come up with an idea, and he would help them figure out how to realize that idea without kind of saying, now you have to make, you know, a horse out of play or something like that. He was very much about helping, guiding, but with a very subtle hand, his students. So it was kind of a light touch as a teacher, with artists or student underrepresented students, and particularly Native American students. He was a very active advocate and champion of recruiting Native students to UW-Madison, other underrepresented art or students to UW-Madison. He was really very committed, and that was largely, I think, because his family, as he was growing up, he was told by his much older sisters and brothers that he was the one who was going to be going to college, to UW-La Crosse. And he had a number of mentors while he was at UW-La Crosse who really sort of helped him along and really gave him great support. So he always, as I said earlier, he always saw that as something that was very important, particularly for Native American students. Once you're thrown into a big university setting, it can be overwhelming. But he, particularly at UW-Madison, as a professor, he really helped to create a supportive, nurturing environment for Native American students, which was pretty spectacular. Education was his passion, and particularly education for underrepresented students.
He not only was a teacher for so many years, but he also was an active curator of exhibits. He took some time away from his teaching, in fact, to be very involved in that with the Smithsonian. I'm wondering, as he had opportunities to curate exhibits of his contemporaries, of other Native American artists, how did he tackle that endeavor?
Well, that's fascinating too. He was at the Smithsonian for several years before the National Museum of the American Indian opened in 2004, and then he was there for about 4 years after it opened as well. And he was invited to assume that position as curator of contemporary art there, and he really saw it as an opportunity where he could introduce, you know, the hundreds of thousands of museum goers who go to the mall in Washington, D.C., go to the Smithsonian. He really felt like he could introduce all those visitors to a broadened kind of conception of what contemporary Native American art could look like. So instead of just being portraits of stoic Indians or being an Indian on horseback, that kind of thing, or the traditional Native arts and crafts, he wanted general museum visitors to see the broad expanse, the possibilities of contemporary Native American creativity. And he went with gusto to that. He had a number of artists that he was interested in exhibiting before he got there, artists from the 20th and 21st century. And he put together some really powerful exhibits of people like Fritz Scholder and George Morrison, Alan Hauser, and then contemporaries, his own generation of artists like Kay Walking Stick and John Quick to See Smith and a number of other artists. So it was a very important curatorship, if I can say that.
Now, since Truman Lowe's passing, you've been involved in making sure that even more people get to be exposed with his art. You work with his family to make sure that some of his works, that more of his works are added to museums' collections. Talk about that process. How do you introduce yourself to these museums and explain to them the opportunity that they have to bring these works into their collection?
Well, to be completely honest, it's kind of an easy sell because his reputation as an artist precedes him. He did not sell many works during his lifetime. He was more interested in making art, and he had a livelihood at the university, so he didn't have to make money from his art. So he wasn't really particularly interested in selling works to museums during his lifetime, although he did, let me be clear. The Denver Art Museum has a beautiful, absolutely exquisite waterfall that he made again, out of wood. But since his passing, and particularly in the climate we're in right now, museums are finally understanding that they need to represent the broad diversity of artists. So not just white men, white male artists, but really to look at women artists, artists of color, and Truman's art, because it is, because it has a very unique but universal kind of aesthetic and appeal, he is being very well received, I should say, by museums. So for example, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago has bought a couple pieces. The Metropolitan Museum in New York has bought pieces, or one piece, I should say. The Smithsonian American Art Museum, as well as the National Museum of the American Indian, have also bought a number of works. So his work is going to Boston Museum of Fine Arts, St. Louis Art Museum. Museums of national reputation are really sort of finally understanding that his work is important and needs to be preserved and collected.
In looking at his work, as you have throughout his career, but especially now in terms of his now being part of history, do you notice common threads? Are there themes in his art, or are there things that he was trying to communicate through his art?
Yes, very much so. I would say his native heritage was one, and then respect and reverence for the natural environment, the natural world, were his two primary concerns. A lot of his sculptures and drawings are about water, moving water, streams, that's freshwater streams. And that was a subject that he returned to over and over again. And in fact, in the Metropolitan Museum in New York right now, one of his signature pieces, it's called Feather Canoe, is included in an exhibit, a very timely exhibit, about water, the politics and also the aesthetics of water. So that's really, I mean, his work is very timely, very contemporary. It's modern and American as much as it is Native American.
Our time is unfortunately coming nearly to a close, but I want to ask you about his legacy. How is there a way to sum up the legacy of someone like Truman Lowe, who is, as you talked about, multifaceted and very deep in the reflective nature of his work?
Well, that is a hard question, and that's why I think I've been struggling with my remarks for Monday's ceremony. I think his primary legacy is as a Native American contemporary artist. He really helped to broaden our perceptions of contemporary Native American art, both in his art and then also as a curator, and even in his teaching, when he supported and nurtured those Native American artists, young students, he was really thinking about the future of contemporary Native American art, of Native American art in general. So I think his legacy is sort of a combination of his artwork about Native American heritage and the woodland environment, and then also his teaching and his curating in a similar vein.
Dr. Jo Otell is the Nystrom Professor Emerita of Art History at Beloit College. She's the author of Woodland Reflections, The Art of Truman Lowe, and we've been talking about Truman Lowe here today on Newsmakers. Jo Otell, thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Jo Otell talking about her longtime colleague and friend, Truman T. Lowe, for whom the Fine Arts Building at UW-La Crosse is now named. It's now known as the Truman T. Lowe Center for the Arts. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to catch this episode again, you can find it online along with all the other programs that we have done over the years. It's wpr.org/newsmakers. That's wpr.org/newsmakers. Our producer is Kate Spranger. Until next time, I'm Ezra Wall. Please join us again next week for another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.